This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we talk with researchers who monitor the health of people exposed to a toxic chemical that got into their food decades ago.
We have found that 60% of the people we tested in the last few years still have elevated levels of PBB in their blood.
And a discussion about climate change. Is new technology enough?
The Tesla is a great car, but it's still a car. And the answer is not more cars.
A conversation about a park that the state and a tribe will co-manage.
This site is special because it is a permanent place of spiritual understanding, reflection, and teaching for the Anishinaabe people.
Plus, we visit a new tiki palace in Grand Rapids.
You can basically walk into a collection of stuff that nobody's seen since the 1950s, 60s.
All of that coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Without a widespread culture shift, the climate crisis won't be solved. That's according to Andrew Hoffman, a climate expert at the University of Michigan.
Do you believe that we as a species have grown to such numbers and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? If you answer yes, that's a huge cultural shift.
We'll revisit that conversation later in the program. But first, on the Detroit River, near the historic Fort Wayne property, a section of the riverbank collapsed into the river. Now, that land is believed to be contaminated with several toxic substances, including some radioactive materials. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton has been looking into this, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Lester.
So what happened? When did this happen?
It happened the day before Thanksgiving. And heavy rains were pouring on this big pile of gravel that was being stored there by Detroit Bulk Storage, and just whoosh, it just, you know, went right into the river, destroyed the barrier there, and poured into the river.
So how did we find out about this?
This is the funny, I guess, part of it. We here in Michigan, media here in Michigan, did not break this story. A fellow by the name of Dave Battagello did this over at the Windsor Star. He called the Michigan Department of Environment last week, days after this happened, and he was the one who notified them that this has happened. So we found out, 9 days later when he published his story.
Wow. Well, I mean, what should have happened? I mean, why was there such a delay?
Well, so the owner of this company, Detroit Bulk Storage, told Dave Battagello that he kind of figured the site, you know, had a clean bill of health. Nobody told him anything different. And he did notify the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Coast Guard. But nobody else, and the U.S. Coast Guard didn't notify state regulators, so nobody found out until Dave published his story. Good for him.
So what kind of toxic materials are we talking about?
Well, all right, so both the state and the U.S. EPA say, as far as they know right now, there is no concern over radiation, because a company that used to be here actually made uranium rods for atomic bombs back in the 40s.
Manhattan Project.
Yes. And so they've done testing over the years. It's all come back as background levels, but there's still a lot of concern about PCBs, which they have done soil removal on this site to get rid of some of these PCBs. We don't know how much of that stuff is still there.
What do we know about safety? I mean, how much of a concern is this? There are water intakes along the river.
Yeah, I think that's what is mainly concerning people, is one of the water intakes for the Detroit Water Authority, which provides water to millions of people in Southeast Michigan, is a few miles downstream from where this happened.
One of their intakes.
They have five, and one of them is downstream. And so that agency says, we're doing some expedited, mainly radiation testing here. We'll let you know as soon as we have the results, but we are pretty sure there's no real concern in terms of radiation.
And what about the PCBs? Have they said anything about those?
Yeah,
yet?
No, they haven't said anything at all about that kind of material yet.
So they'll have to be doing a lot of testing. What's next in this, I'll call it a debacle?
So the state says they are looking into whether Detroit Bulk Storage had a, quote, due care obligation to let them know that this happened. They're really not sure who should have let them know.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, like you said, good work for the Windsor Star.
Yeah, kudos to them.
That's Tracy Samilton with Michigan Radio. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we are surrounded by tiki material everywhere.
We are at Max's South Seas Hideaway, and this is Grand Rapids' brand new tiki bar, and I have been dying to make it here, and I'm so glad that I did. And we've got Mark Sellers with us today.
So what was the idea behind it?
Well, I've been wanting to do a tiki bar for years. I own some other restaurants, but I've collected and been a fan of tiki bars for years. So about 5 years ago, I got this idea that I was going to do it, and I just never got around to it till this year.
Every square inch of wall, ceiling, and floor is tiki-themed. That looks like you've been collecting for a while.
So in 2017, I bought a collection of tiki artifacts that had been collected over years by a guy in California. And it was a large collection of vintage tiki stuff from old Trader Vic's locations, Kona Kai, Contiki, Hawaiian Hut, all these old famous tiki bars that are now torn down and gone. But I've got all these hundreds of artifacts from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s that I had in my collection that we now have inside Max's. So you can basically walk into a collection of stuff that nobody's seen since the 1950s, 60s.
This is a tiki history museum.
Yep. I don't use the word museum that often because I'm afraid people will think that means, you know, boring or kind of stodgy, but it is kind of like a museum for tiki fanatics, yeah.
So I have visited a lot of tiki bars, and the only other ones that I've seen that have this sort of level of decor are those last few remaining tiki palaces from the 1960s, the Mai Kai in Fort Lauderdale, Hala Kahiki in Chicago. And so this, to me, I walked in, and I was like, this is what it would have been like to walk into a new tiki palace back in the 60s. Sure.
The whole idea of a place like this is that you forget there is an outside world when you're in here. It's an escape from reality, and we get people that are in here 3-4 hours because they just kind of don't want to leave. It just feels so nice, warm, and inviting, and especially in the winter. You don't want to go outside into that Michigan winter once you're in here.
How does that translate to the drinks you make here?
Well, the drinks were developed by my business partner on this project. His name is Martin Cait. He's a James Beard Award winner for a mixology book that he wrote a couple years ago. And so we use recipes from his book, which he wrote and trained all the bartenders. And we've got 45 cocktails on the menu. They use a lot of fresh squeezed fruit juices, so no pre-squeezed or nothing frozen. Everything's squeezed in-house. We make our own syrups. We have our own recipes and names for the drinks.
Martin Cait is really one of the big names in tiki in America right now. So that, for me, when I heard that he was involved in this, I was really excited. You have another partner too, right?
Yeah,
Gecko?
That's right. He's a Hawaiian artist named Gecko. So it's me, Martin Cait, and Gecko, the three of us partnered on this bar.
Yeah. Well, after all that talk about tiki, I think tiki drinks are next, right?
Let's do it.
So I'm standing here at the bar with Jeremy Williams, and he's got a great lineup of ingredients here. Jeremy, what drink are you making for us today?
This is the Max's South Sea Swizzle. It features the New Holland Freshwater Rum as well as a Michigan maple syrup.
Well, how do you make this thing?
So this recipe calls for a 3/4 ounce freshly squeezed lime juice, 1/2 ounce of the Michigan maple syrup. We use 1/2 ounce of John D. Taylor's Velvet Falernum. We use 1/2 ounce of Plantation Overproof OFTD rum, and we use 1.5 ounces of New Holland's Freshwater Rum.
Lester and I have used that New Holland barrel rum. It's really good, but it lacks a little bit of the depth that we sometimes look for in tiki drinks, so I really thought it was fun to see you blend that with a heavier Caribbean rum to bring some of those flavors, and that's really classic tiki form.
What was that rum again?
So it's called Plantation OFTD. It's an overproof rum. It's a blend of rums from Jamaica, Guyana, and Barbados.
So is this the popular one on the list? Is this a signature cocktail?
It is a signature cocktail, and it is relatively popular. The idea of blending the rums in the tiki culture is there just to ensure that a complexity and depth of flavor is achieved.
And then you used a technique that we haven't talked about on this show before. Usually we've shaken drinks, we've stirred drinks, we've even built drinks and talked about that. But what was the technique you used to mix this one up?
A swizzle cocktail is a name that reflects the manner in which the drink was made rather than what goes into it itself. And we use a tool called a lele. to rub between our hands, to move around that crushed ice really rapidly, almost like blending it in the glass so that it's just frosted to perfection, in other words.
So folks at home probably don't have a lele that they can use. What could you use at home if you wanted to swizzle this drink up?
A bar spoon. I would even say go ahead and use the cocktail shaker if you'd like. You can get away with it here.
So with the bar spoon, you just, like you used your hands to rub it back and forth to make it rotate, you do the same thing with the bar spoon?
Yeah, any bar spoon with a coil, really, that runs vertically.
All right, well, let's take a taste of this. Tammy, you want to have a sip?
I don't know that
When it comes to tiki drinks, that's about all I get out of her. Wow, that's got some depth. There are layers there.
Yeah, so you get all your nice spice elements from this, the citrus and the Caribbean flavors, but we also introduce a little bit of a rustic element with that Michigan maple syrup.
You know, it's a kind of a running joke on this episode because I don't like rum. I'm told that I just haven't had it right, and boy, if that's going to be rum for me in the future, I want it. That's really nice.
Spend more time here. We're going to have about 160 rums on our list for you to...
All right, well, cheers.
Cheers.
We like to hear from you. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Still to come, the Saginaw Chippewa Tribe and the state of Michigan will soon begin to co-manage the Sanilac Petroglyphs Historic State Park. That's the first ever partnership of its kind in Michigan.
Around the nation, there are hundreds. Most people think of petroglyphs and they think of the American Southwest. In the Great Lakes region, there are the Peterborough Petroglyphs in Ontario. There's the Jeffers Petroglyphs in Minnesota. And most people don't know that we have petroglyphs right here in Michigan.
We'll revisit a conversation about what makes that park special. That's coming up later on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A team from Emory University is in Michigan this week to take blood samples from people exposed to polybrominated biphenyl, or PBB. PBB is a toxic flame retardant, which in the 1970s was accidentally sent by a chemical plant in St. Louis, Michigan, to a Farm Bureau feed center where it was mixed in cattle feed. That accident wasn't discovered by regulators for about a year. Millions of people ate food contaminated by PBB. The Emory University team has been monitoring some of those people exposed to PBB over the years. Michelle Marcus is a professor in the Departments of Epidemiology and Environmental Health and Pediatrics at the Schools of Public Health and Medicine at Emory. She joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Lester.
So how long has the Emory team been monitoring the health effects of this toxic PBB contamination?
So we have been working on monitoring the health effects for about 25 years, and it's only because of the foresight of the state health department that set up this long-term registry that we have been able to find out what the long-term health effects are to the people who were exposed.
Well, I want to talk about that in a second, but tell us about the work you'll be doing this weekend. You'll be taking blood samples, you'll be meeting with people?
Yes, that's right. So we are holding a community meeting at the Ingham County Health Department tomorrow, Saturday. And also we will be up in Bad Axe on Sunday at the Franklin Inn. There are a number of purposes to these meetings. You know, most importantly is to share with the community what we have learned about the health effects so that they can use that information with their doctors to protect their health, and also to take blood samples and to do further research. And really, the research that we're doing now is a direct response to the community's concerns over the years when we have held these community meetings around the state. People have told us about the illnesses in their families and their concerns. So what we are doing now is trying to address those concerns, trying to look at health effects that we had not looked at previously, such as arthritis and joint pain, as well as neurologic problems. So we have a very comprehensive health questionnaire. We will be measuring PBB levels in people's blood. And this is really important because even though this incident happened 40 years ago, we have found that 60% of the people we have tested in the last few years still have elevated levels of PBB in their blood.
Wow. Are these health effects limited to the people who were actually exposed, or are their children or grandchildren also affected?
Yes, that's actually the most disturbing part of this work, is that we have found that a developing child in the womb and in childhood is much more vulnerable to a toxic chemical than adults are. So we found that the children of women who were exposed got exposed in the womb and through breast milk. For example, the girls who were exposed in the womb and through breast milk, they had their first menstrual period earlier than girls who were not exposed. And now that they are adults, they have a much higher rate of pregnancy loss. So that's the loss of the grandchild of the woman who was first exposed. And we're also very concerned about the children and grandchildren of men who were exposed. And this is one of a focus of the research that we're doing now, is that we are trying to determine whether a man's exposure or the impact of that exposure can also be passed on to his children and grandchildren, as we've seen for women who were exposed.
The chemical plant in St. Louis, Michigan Chemical, was in business for decades before this mix-up of PBB and cattle feed. It produced other chemicals. Are you testing for those other chemicals?
We would like to. We had some limited funding to test for DDT in about 500 individuals who worked at the chemical plant or lived in the community. And we did find elevated levels of DDT among the workers at the Velsicol chemical plant, but not in the surrounding community. So we are currently testing for PBB and PCB only, but we are hoping to get additional funds to test for other chemicals.
Once you've met and tested Michigan residents exposed to PBB, what's next in your work?
So we are very interested in giving this information back to the community and for the community to decide, you know, how best to use this information. So, for example, we found an increased risk of breast cancer for women who were exposed. And it's important for women to know this so they don't think, oh, well, you know, I don't have a family history of breast cancer, I'm not at high risk, and maybe I'll skip my mammogram this year. Well, you know, women who lived in the state during this time period should not skip their mammograms. It's really important for them and their physicians to be aware that they might be at increased risk of breast cancer. We've also found increased risks of thyroid problems, and that's also important for people to know and discuss with their doctors, because sometimes a thyroid disorder is difficult to diagnose, yet the test for it is very simple. So it may appear, you know, as a wide range of symptoms, but if somebody's been exposed to PBB, the doctor should think thyroid and do a screening test.
And we should note that this is not just people who were in the area of this plant, but millions of people in Michigan ended up eating food that was contaminated by PBB. So anyone in Michigan you're talking about who was around 40 years ago should be thinking about this.
That's exactly right.
Michelle Marcus is a professor in the Departments of Epidemiology and Environmental Health and Pediatrics at the Schools of Public Health and Medicine at Emory University. She'll be meeting with people who were exposed to PBB 40 years ago. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Lester.
I want to recommend the articles by Bridge Magazine's Michigan Environment Watch team. You can find the stories on PBB and what we can learn from that to inform the new challenge of PFAS contamination. Those stories were released November 18th. I also want to recommend the reporting on PBB by my Michigan radio colleagues such as Rebecca Williams, Lindsay Smith, and others. Their reports go back for years. We'll link to it when we post this interview online at michiganradio.org. The Saginaw Chippewa Tribe and the state of Michigan will soon begin to co-manage the Sanilac Petroglyphs Historic State Park. That's the first ever partnership of its kind in the state. The petroglyphs, or rock carvings within the park, date back some 1,400 years and are sacred to the tribe. But the state park has struggled to attract as many visitors as the Department of Natural Resources and the tribe would like. In 2016, I spoke to archaeologists Stacy Chorzinski and Shannon Martin, director of the Zibwing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways, about what makes the park so special and how they plan to draw more visitors. Stacy, where is this park?
The park is in the Thumb region of Michigan. It is near Cass City and Bad Axe. It's in a deeply rural area. It's 240 acres of floodplain forest along the Cass River, surrounded by agricultural land.
Shannon, I want to ask you what makes this site special. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about the proper way to identify your people or your tribe. You're with the Anishinaabe Center, but we also hear Ojibwa and Chippewa, as I mentioned earlier. Which should we use or not use? Which is proper?
Those are all proper.
Oh, good.
Absolutely. Chippewa is the federal government recognized name for the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan. However, our oldest language, it refers to Ojibwe. So there was a slight inflection during the government treaty era signing times with the language, and Ojibwe turned into Chippewa. But Anishinaabe is the term in the Ojibwe language that refers to the original people. So it would be Chippewa, Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, or Potawatomi Anishinaabe, or Ottawa Anishinaabe. It's the people.
The people, which is what I had been told in the past, that, you know, when you refer to your tribe, you refer to the people because we are the people. What is this site? Why is it special to the Chippewa tribe?
This site is special because it is a permanent place of spiritual understanding, reflection, and teaching for the Anishinaabe people. So not just the Ojibwe, but the Ottawa, Potawatomi, the Lenni Lenape, and those tribes that called Michigan home at one time that were Aboriginal here. So tribes that were removed or migrated to other parts of America, say like the Kickapoo, Sac and Fox, Miami. The site is significant to all of us because on that grandfather stone, we call it, or grandmother stone, contains very important teachings and messages that our ancestors left for us for future generations to learn from, to understand, and to take that knowledge and carry it into the future.
Now, we call these petroglyphs, and I want Stacy to explain to me what a petroglyph is.
Petroglyphs are carvings in stone as opposed to something like a pictograph, which is a drawing or painting on stone. So they're carvings in rock. From an archaeological point of view, they're just that, carvings in rock. But from a tribal perspective, they are teachings in rock.
So what kind of outcropping of rock is this? I mean, what kind of stone are we talking about?
It's a very soft marshal sandstone, and this is a landscape that was created millions of years ago. And then through glaciation, about 13,000 years ago, the Ubli Channel went through the area, a wide riverbed. And that deposited sediments that over time became the soft marshal sandstone and created the whole Cass River waterway. With the development of the Cass River system, it sort of unlocked these outcrops of marshal sandstone, and those were the outcrops that First Peoples came and placed the carvings on.
So let's talk about those petroglyphs. What are some of these symbols? What do they mean?
One symbol in particular, probably the most prominent one that people recognize on that particular site, is called Emnodokwit in the language, and that's the shooter of knowledge into the future. the archaeologists and those that the historians call it the archer. But that carving in itself is a reminder to all people who see that, that our ancestors thought about us. They had great intention to leave those teachings on that rock for us to learn from one day. And that particular Ebnodakowit is representational of those ancestors, shooting
so
knowledge.
Shoot an arrow with seven generations in the
into
future.
The future. Yeah. And then the body of Ebnodakowit is an arrow as well. If you go and visit the site, which we hope you do, the arrow of the body is going directly to the creator. So that means that we always have the direct connection to our creator.
How many sites of petroglyphs are there around the nation?
Around the nation, there are hundreds. Most people think of petroglyphs and they think of the American Southwest. In the Great Lakes region, there are the Peterborough petroglyphs in Ontario. There's the Jeffers petroglyphs in Minnesota. And most people don't know that we have petroglyphs right here in Michigan.
So it's fairly rare in the Great Lakes region.
It is fairly rare for the United States portion of the Great Lakes region, yes.
And I assume part of this is because if it's this kind of loose sandstone, it's going to be weather-worn pretty easily. What's being done to protect the petroglyphs at this site?
It's a challenge. Being soft martial sandstone, it's susceptible to freeze and thaw and touch and sunshine and moss and lichen. And there's no perfect way to protect a site like this. It was meant to be in this floodplain landscape. The carvings are connected to its natural landscape. It was meant to be in an open, natural environment. What the state of Michigan had done since they had acquired the property was they built an awning over it in the 80s to try to protect it from some weathering and rain and snow. And what we think that might be doing is not letting enough sunlight onto the rock. And so we get moss and lichen that
does its own damage.
Grow from the rock and does its own damage. So it's a balance between trying to learn what the site needs from a technical preservation point of view and what it also needs from a cultural preservation point of view. And the state of Michigan is being taught that piece by our tribes.
Both of you, though, want more visitors to the site. Both of you want to let people in the state and around the Great Lakes region to know about this. But I read in an Associated Press story that there's a chain link fence topped with barbed wire. That doesn't sound like you're encouraging visitors. What's going on there?
We're working on that, too. Currently, the site is open from Wednesday through Sunday. It's from Memorial Day to Labor Day. The trails are always open. The park is open, but there's an enclosure that surrounds the pavilion above the carvings. Unfortunately, over the years, people have taken it upon themselves to leave graffiti and disrespect and mistreat the site. And the worst offenses of those actually happened prior to the 1920s and 1930s, where some of the carvings were actually chipped out and stolen. And a lot of graffiti was left. And you can even see graffiti that was left by 19th century loggers on the rock. And unfortunately, graffiti is a phenomenon that happens at rock art sites worldwide. It's something that's very hard to prevent. In the earlier years, the DNR erected this fence around the pavilion when it was not being interpreted during open hours. They wanted to keep people from disrespecting, stealing, vandalism. And it is not the most elegant solution. And part of what we're doing now is working on a series of grants for a series of solutions at the site, not only to reinterpret it multivocally and from a tribal-led perspective, but also to look at the conservation of the stone itself, what it needs, how much light is this covering working, what is this fence doing or really not doing. And we want to come up with some more culturally appropriate and welcoming solutions that physically protect the area because we all want to see it last as long as it can, but also be more respectful to the natural context that it sits in. And the fence isn't doing that, but at the same time, it's a challenge to come up with an appropriate physical barrier that can protect the site when it's not being monitored. It's a beautiful park with trails and amazing brand new interpretive signage that we just put up that's bilingual in English and Anishinaabe Mo'en, and there's a lot to see, and the petroglyphs are very much there to see. So it's a gorgeous park. It's a gem of a park.
It sounds like it's a tough balance to encourage people to come see, recognize, and at the same time protect these petroglyphs. I mean, you're on the air right now encouraging people to come and visit this site. When they get there, are you going to be able to handle it and keep it all under control in a way that preserves the site?
Yeah, those are, you know, some of the tough questions that we're grappling with, and these grants are helping to facilitate those discussions. Stacy and I were part of a 5-year grant program called Intellectual Property Issues in Cultural Heritage, and that project was administered through Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. through that grant, our case study was focused solely on the satellite petroglyphs, looking at the cultural preservation versus intellectual property issues, what could be shared, what couldn't be shared spiritually and from an Anishinaabe perspective. And then we were looking at long-term preservation of the site and the carvings. What could we come up with as a best solution to preserve the site as long as possible? So we actually took a trip to Peterborough to visit the glyphs there. There's a wonderful relationship going on between the Curve Lake First Nation Ojibwe and the Ministry of Natural Resources, the Parks in Ontario. They actually have an enclosure, a temperature and humidity controlled covering building over their petroglyphs. So we went there and we learned from both sides, from the government side and from the tribal perspective, what worked and what didn't work. So that's really, you know, something as a foundation to inform us in our work as we look at developing a future management and preservation plan for Sanilac.
That's Shannon Martin. She's the director of the Zibwing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways. Also, we've been hearing from Stacy Chorzinski. She's an archaeologist at the Michigan State Historic Preservation Office and the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks very much for both of you coming in and explaining the site to us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Still to come, does putting up solar panels on your house and buying an electric car truly help fight global climate change? Maybe not.
Buy an electric car? I can now thump my chest. I am virtuous. I've addressed the problem. I'm living the good life. And it's you bad people that are driving the SUV. If you drove an electric, the world would be a wonderful place. And it's not going to work that way.
That's next, here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You know, we all want to fix a problem, and we come up with a plan, and we come up with the tools, and we get to work. But what if the problem we need to fix is us? I recently read an article about climate change, which challenged my thinking about what needs to be done to curtail the greenhouse gas emissions causing global heating. The title of the piece in Behavioral Scientist is Climate Change and Our Emerging Cultural Shift. The author is Andrew Hoffman, and he joins us now. Welcome back to Stateside.
Well, it's good to be here.
All right. You write, you give talks about attitudes about climate change. And in this piece you wrote, you mentioned you get a lot of hate mail and angry people approaching you. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, it came after when I first started writing about this. And it was funny. I wrote an article in a journal you probably never heard of called Organizational Dynamics. And it came out and it did what academic journal articles do. It sits someplace and no one reads it. And then there was an analogy in there to the cultural shift around climate change being akin to the cultural shift around the abolition of slavery, recognizing that there are some distinct differences between the cruelty of one race against another, but there are interesting parallels. And the paper went out, put a line on my resume, do what academics do, and then the New York Times picked it up, that slavery abolition thing. And then Scientific American and Time Magazine, I'm thinking, oh, this is cool. I'm a public intellectual. And then someone emailed me and said, I see Mark Morano is taking his hits at you. And I was new to this. And I said, who's Mark Morano? And he said, he used to work for James Inhofe. He used to work for Rush Limbaugh. He has a page called climatedepot.com. I think you better go look at it. I went. The coverage of the article was entirely climate skeptics are the moral equivalent of slave owners and my email address. And the emails start pouring in.
Right. Yeah. You also had some personal encounters that you mentioned. Tell us about one of those. And I like these because this gets to a big part of the cultural difference between academics like yourself and the religious folks who are kind of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, if you will, on this. Even if they feel that, you know, the science is correct and climate warming is happening, they can't take that back to the church because,
well, maybe yes or no. I mean, where I'm going in this paper is that if it connects to our religious beliefs, it will motivate action in ways that will be far more powerful.
But you're talking about trying to change somebody's dogma. We're going to get into that a little bit. But tell me about one of these experiences where you had to had somebody basically saying, you're blaspheming my religion by claiming that the earth is warming and we're causing it and we can do something about it.
Well, a lot of my work has been around why do people reject the science of climate change? And the conclusion of this work is that for many people, the debate is not about CO2. It's not about climate models. It's about worldviews that they feel are threatened. One of the major worldviews that some people feel is threatened is their belief in God. And to me, that's so powerful to make this point, because what do we do when we're faced with someone who doesn't believe in climate change? We give them more scientific data. But if they're hearing a threat to their belief in God, you're missing the point and you're never going to get through to them.
So why is it a threat to their belief in God?
Well, so, you know, Rush Limbaugh devoted an entire episode of his show to the idea that you can't believe in God and believe in climate change at the same time, because we are not in charge out there. God is in charge out there. We live by his divine providence. And to suggest otherwise is extreme hubris. Or the millennia-old doctrine in there, right here in Ann Arbor, someone hold up a Bible in front of me in one of my talks and said, God promised Noah he would not flood the earth again. The seas cannot be rising. Or I gave a talk out towards Grand Rapids, and a woman came to me and she was struggling because she said, you know, I believe in science, I believe in climate change, but I come from a deeply fundamentalist family, and they look at climate change through the lens of Revelations. And if Revelations brings the world to an end through fire and climate change looks like it's going that way, maybe this is God's will, and why should we fight it? And that really speaks, particularly within academia. A lot of people are dismissive of religion. Yet, if you're going against someone's deeply held religious beliefs or their deeply philosophical beliefs, we could be talking about the Bible or the Torah. We can also be talking about Rousseau or Locke.
Right.
You know, and that's the key. What is our conception of our place on earth, our purpose for being here? Climate change goes that deep, and the broader issue goes that deep, which is the Anthropocene.
Which, yeah, we need to explain that.
Yeah.
And I'll get to it, I promise.
I was careful not to put that in the title because that was just going to scare people away.
So as I mentioned, when we're faced with a problem, we want to get our tools to fix it. And in the case of climate change, you know, our tools are windmills and solar panels. Yeah. And tech can fix this, can't it?
It can address symptoms. It won't address the problem. The Tesla is a great car, but it's still a car. And the answer is not more cars. The answer is thinking differently about mobility. The answer comes down to a deep shift in our culture, which the point I make in the paper is on a scale akin to the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution or the Protestant Reformation. And the key to that analogy, there are several, but those were fundamental shifts in our cultural beliefs as a species, a fundamental shift in our perception of the environment, and a fundamental shift in how we saw the two connected. And importantly, those shifts took 100 years. And so when people say, you know, in all due respect to James Hansen, and I'll get attacked for this, but when he said, open the Keystone Pipeline and it's game over for the planet, that is not helpful, nor is it accurate. We can't think about this as a sprint. This is a marathon. I believe in the paper, the shift has begun. And it's begun in some hard to see, perhaps even imperceptible ways, but it has begun. And there's a quote I love from William Gibson. He says that the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed.
Right. Yeah.
And so there are shifts occurring, but many people did not know the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution were happening at the time. Those terms very often were coined years after, centuries after, by historians trying to make sense out of this period of tumult. So we may not know what's happening right now.
You're talking about a re-enlightenment.
A re-enlightenment. And I, you know, I've gotten blowback on using that term because a lot of people look at enlightenment as having a lot of political baggage because they see that as the beginning of colonialism, white man's burden, and that's not what I'm trying to say here. But I do think the analogy is apropos because it's that big. Aldo Leopold, who was an ecologist at the University of Wisconsin, he wrote, "No important change in ethics was ever accomplished without an internal change in our intellectual emphasis, loyalties, affections, and convictions. The proof that conservation has not yet touched these foundations of conduct lies in the fact that philosophy and religion have not yet heard of it. In our attempt to make conservation easy, we have made it trivial." And I look at climate change right now, and in an attempt to make climate change easy, we have made it trivial. Buy an electric car, I can now thump my chest, I am virtuous, I've addressed the problem, I'm living the good life, and it's you bad people that are driving the SUV. If you drove an electric, the world will be a wonderful place, and it's not going to work that way.
So you're asking us for life changes that some people will see as sacrifice.
Yep.
So how is that going to win friends and influence people?
I'm just pointing out the obvious reality. I'm not here to win friends and influence people.
And we should point out, you're not just talking about climate change, but you're talking about a lot of the different things that are contributing to
a really dire situation for this planet and for the human race.
But, and we're talking about a culture change that, you know, humans are quite adaptive. I mentioned J.B. McKinnon's book, The Once and Future World, where he points out that we're born into a world, we take it for granted, we watch it change before our eyes, we become sad at the decay, the next generation is born into a world they accept, and then they watch it, and that cycle repeats itself. But the bigger issue here, and if I can rephrase the climate change question into a cultural question, do you believe that we as a species have grown to such numbers and our technology to such power that we can alter the global climate? If you answer yes, that's a huge cultural shift. It's huge. And the idea that we merely need to buy an electric car and live our lives as we always have, that's not going to happen. Now, is it sacrifice or is it just adaptation? We live lives right now that people 100 years ago would find appalling. I love to point out that when Graham Bell started putting up telephone poles, people were really offended. They were cutting them down. There were mayors around the country saying, cut those poles down. He hired Pinkerton guards to protect the poles. Now we take them for granted. Is that a sacrifice? I don't think so. And so where are we going with mobility, with the electric grid, with food? There are changes. They're happening around us right now. And that's where I see the enlightenment taking place, the re-enlightenment taking place.
So what you're talking about is a little hard to get your arms around. So I'm going to use a different metaphor here. What kind of lens should we be looking through to enable us to see what you're talking about?
Well, to begin with, is just recognizing that this is much bigger and much deeper. The answer is not going to, I mean, the market is expedient. If I put a price on this, if I put a price on carbon, it's an important step. The culture will shift with that. They go hand in hand. Anthony Giddens wrote about structuration theory, that culture and technology are in like this spiral. And as we change technology, it changes culture in ways very often we didn't anticipate. The birth control pill brings about the sexual revolution, and it continues. The cotton gin, in many ways, made the Civil War possible because slavery was dying under its own weight. The printing press created the Reformation. And so recognition of the Anthropocene. And it's more than climate change. It's species extinction. It's nitrogen runoff.
I was going to say, define what Anthropocene means.
So the Anthropocene is geophysical scientists have argued that we've left the Holocene. We've entered the Anthropocene. We've entered a new geological epoch. This is not a philosophical statement. They actually have to do it through the geological strata on the Earth. So the way I like to describe it, if we died as a species today, in 1,000 years from now, archaeologists start digging, they will hit a layer. And they'll say, what happened here? What happened here is humans. They'll find radioactive isotopes. That's important because when they made the proposal that we're in the Anthropocene, they have to define something they call the golden spike. It's an actual place where we can actually show you the geological strata change. They're putting the golden spike at the first atomic bomb because that just spread radioactive isotopes around the Earth. And so now it's going through formal approval. But within the Anthropocene, they define 9 planetary boundaries, or boundaries we should not cross if we want to maintain a stable living environment for humans and other life forms. And one is in retreat, ozone depletion. 3 of them we're crossing. Climate change, nitrogen. We produce more nitrogen as the natural processes. We put it in farms. We know this in Michigan, the algae blooms, the dead zone in the Mississippi River, and species extinction. Scientists say we're in the middle of a sixth mass extinction.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the Anthropocene. And sometimes you need to hear it in a way that just really shocks you into, oh, wait, something's weird here, because we take things for granted. Like here in Michigan, we take for granted you can't eat fish out of the lakes because of mercury and other kinds of pollution. We take that for granted.
I'm actually surprised when I talk to people that they don't realize that there are places in this state where there's DDT in the fish at a level that we can't eat the fish. Yeah. We've got PCBs, we've got dioxins, now we've got PFAS that we know about, and many other chemicals in fish at high enough levels that you either should not eat it at all, or you should limit your intake to maybe 1 or 2 fish a month.
And if you're a pregnant woman, don't even go near it. And we take that for granted.
Yeah, that's normal now.
Yeah, and I put it in the paper. I was talking to a research chemist at a pharmaceutical company, and he said very matter-of-factly, he said, you know, there's measurable levels of ibuprofen in the Mediterranean Sea. And I was like, whoa. And he said, hey, that doesn't concern us. It's a fairly benign compound. What worries us is birth control pills and antidepressants. You take a drug, pass through your system, treatment plant can't handle it, enters the aquatic ecosystem, changes the flora and the fauna.
Yeah, my colleague Rebecca Williams has reported on this a few times. It's happening here. We can detect those pharmaceuticals in the water in Michigan.
Biologists were looking at salmon in Puget Sound 2 years ago, and they found Prozac. They found 40 prescription drugs. They even found cocaine. And guess what? That salmon's ending up on your restaurant dinner plate. And that's the Anthropocene.
And who knows what kind of impact it's having on the evolution of fish and amphibians and reptiles.
And we haven't even talked about plastics. I mean, scientists predict that by 2050, believe it or not, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish by weight. And you need these kind of statistics to say, holy smokes, what's going on? Yet we'll get numb to that too. You know, we'll just sort of accept that.
I thought when the study came out that showed microplastics in bottled water, in tap water, in beer, that there would be this huge outrage, but apparently everybody feels like, well it's going to be filtered out. I mean, you know, it's just not going to be a problem. All right, so we've talked about this huge shift, a planetary shift. How can you even begin to make a paradigm shift of this magnitude in people's culture?
What I'm saying in the paper is religion is key here. So we started talking about hate mail and religion is the obstacle. And I'm saying religion is a solution and philosophy is a solution. My argument does not leave out secular humanists. You don't have to believe in God, but it comes down to our fundamental belief about why are we here? It's really existential questions. And
are we here to dominate or are we here to be good stewards?
Right. And so I fixated on Pope Francis's encyclical letter Laudato Si. And I think it's an interesting document for really laying out a set of moral beliefs that we are, he doesn't use the word Anthropocene, but he is pointing out that we are starting to live in a world that is not very nice. We are damaging it. I love in the Catholic Catechism where they say pollution is actually theft from future generations. This is the beginning of really starting to examine some deeper questions around, well, if climate change is real, what does it mean for me mowing my lawn in Ann Arbor? That has impact for people in low-lying areas of Bangladesh. Now we're going to start to have a very serious conversation. How do you talk to people in small island states who are starting to look at the end of their habitable environment? And they didn't even do it. I mean, that's an important element here, too, is that the poor people that are getting hit by this are ones that didn't even do this. And so that really starts to get us to reexamine issues around ethics, around morals, in ways that we really haven't done, and I don't think we're fully prepared to do. But when you put it on that plane, you start to see that there's something really big here. And how can we come to terms with it? That's, again, if people hear about this from the church, the mosque, the synagogue, the temple, it connects to their deepest sense of who they are. And then get out of the way, because religion can explain, you know, Nelson Mandela. Rationality can't. Religion can explain Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War and holding firm to the idea of keeping the Union together. Rationality does not. And I put far more hope in faith to get us through the big challenges we have than a logical calculation that the odds are in my favor.
And my prediction is you're going to get hate mail from all sides just based on this one conversation. I mean, it's people do not want to be challenged like this, but what else can you do when you're faced with the kind of things we're faced?
When I first started getting hate mail, someone gave me a quote, and I haven't been able to attribute it. They told me it was from Winston Churchill. I haven't been able to verify it, but it's a wonderful quote. It says, if you're not offending anyone, you never took a stand. And it's an important quote for any academic who wants to get into the public debate. I have many scientists who tell me, oh, my work is not political. And my answer is, if you're challenging the way people think or behave, you are by definition political, and people will push back. If they don't push back, you didn't say anything important. And so accept that as part of the domain. And there's two other quotes that I really love. I heard one from Paul Newman, of all people. He said, if you don't have enemies, you don't have character. Now, I might flop that a little bit. There are people with enemies that deserve them. But if you have character, if you're standing up for what you think is right, you will have enemies. Or another one, I heard a friend say this a couple of months ago, and I said, you got to repeat that. And he said, you only get shot at when you're over the target. All of them speak to the idea that if you're saying something important, You're challenging how people think. If you challenge how people think, they're not going to like it. But change is painful. Change is hard. And this argument in this article, it applies to all of us. Even the most liberal who's just accepted climate change lock, stock, and barrel, if you think the answer is a windmill and electric car, you're not thinking big enough.
Andrew Hoffman is a professor at the University of Michigan with joint appointments at the Ross School of Business and the School for Environment and Sustainability. He's the author of several books, including How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, thanks, Lester. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Tad Davis, Catherine Newhan, and Adam Reyes. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.